Welcome, welcome to episode 6 of Think You Know the Presidents. I'm Lise Hand.
And I'm Flora McCarthy. And today we're talking about Ireland's marathon man, you could say, when it comes to presidential terms, Patrick Paddy Hillary. Hillary was an Irish Fianna Fáil politician who served as the 6th President of Ireland from December 1976 to December 1990.
Yeah, we've had along the short fellas. We've had De Valera, we've had O'Kelly, we've had the quiet one, Hyde, and then the one who resigned in O'Dolig. We've had the one unfortunately died in office, Childers, and now the low-key one from...
Don't forget the sexiest.
Ah, come on, steady on, floor.
No, I'm serious. It's apparently he was once voted the world's sexiest head of state by readers of the German magazine Der Spiegel. But I was thinking about this, and who else did we have at the time? Okay, so there was Juan Carlos in Spain, there was Maggie Thatcher.
She certainly wore the trousers in the like in the British...
That air of authority, maybe.
We have with us actually today, I suppose you call him the president of the Today FM's The Last Word Show, Matt Cooper.
Thank you, but I didn't come with sideburns, which by the sounds of it is what's required. Our flared trousers, which would have been very popular in the period between 1976 and 1990.
Yeah, but chances are, Matt, you probably had a mullet at some stage, did you? I mean, that was very much the haircut of the
time. You're trading on inside information from that period now, which is quite unfair, but anyway.
Listen, we've 14 years to get through, so... There's a sex scandal too in the mix.
Have you got sex on the brain today? I mean, are you absolutely sure it's not Patrick Swayze we're talking about here?
My hope for Ireland is that we turn away from acrimony, dissension and disagreement, which are destroying everything that we should value, and join our hearts and minds in united cause for the peace and well-being of all.
Paddy Hillary, I mean, did he have one of those sort of action-packed, dramatic lives that we've seen in some of the presidents up to date now, or was it all fairly low-key and quiet?
Well, compared to, say, fighting on the streets in 1916 and all of that, no. He had a very quiet upbringing, very, you know, traditional middle class. He was born in 1923 in beautiful Spanish Point in West Clare. His father was a local GP, his mother was a district nurse. Young Paddy went off to study medicine as well, following in his parents' footsteps, and later joined the practice himself as a GP.
Actually, do you know, probably one of the most interesting things about his young life, and it's probably something that happened that he has no memory of, actually, was his father, Michael. He'd actually been a medical officer to the Midclare Brigade of the IRA during the War of Independence, and his home actually became a refuge for men on the run. And the night before his wife gave birth to their son Desmond, which would have been Paddy's brother, didn't the Black and Tans burn down the house? And Des, the baby, was actually born in a hotel in Milltown Malbay in the town. And Paddy and his sisters and his two sisters were sort of smuggled away to safety to an aunt in Nina. And his father ended up serving a 9-month term in prison. So he did actually have a little bit of that background.
And it's amazing that that same house, years later, there was a petition on it by the IRA during the H-block era. I found a diary entry of his in the archives in which he was trying to explain to his kids why there were Gardaí with guns and cars at the bottom of the garden.
God, that's extraordinary. Mm.
Why was it delivered to his house in Clare rather than into Warris?
That's a great question. It seems to be because they were approaching him as a doctor, and they said that his Hippocratic oath, which he took in medical school, preceded his oath of office for president. And so they were appealing to him as a doctor, for God's sake, do something about these.
Isn't the oath of office for the president in some way superior to that of the Hippocratic oath?
Well, that was their reasoning. So 1955, he married May Flanagan, who was also a doctor. They had one son, John, and their daughter, Vivian, who very sadly died of cancer as a teenager. She was just 17.
When Vivian died, they were in the Arras, and it never became a story.
It didn't.
They felt that this was a really private thing, and they were a very private family, and he was a very private president.
And that was respected by the press, actually.
And it was respected by the press, and that's another theme running through this as well, as how the press handled various dramas.
And how different it is nowadays.
Oh, very different. So, I mean, it looked like he was ready for a long and uneventful life being a local GP. Then fate and our old friend Eamon de Valera. I can't believe he's back in this story. I mean, it's unbelievable. He has literally haunted every episode of this story
and will do until he's 90.
And actor part, shall we say, to play in the precedence.
Fianna Fáil were apparently renewing the party, and they still had in the front ranks some of the older TDs going right back to the 1920s and the War of Independence era and all of that. They wanted to refresh the party. They came looking for candidates and they thought this guy, Dr. Patrick Hillary, would make a very good candidate. So he was approached by Dev. Apparently, Hillary hadn't really thought of politics as being his future yet, but he was persuaded.
He was selected as his running mate in 1951, became a TD, where he actually stayed for over 20 years until 1973.
He did, and he had several ministries. His first was as Minister for Education, and there's a lovely story he told himself about how he told Jean Lemass, then Taoiseach, that, you know, that's going to be a very busy portfolio. I can't possibly do it. I still have some medical cases on the go down in County Clare. Lemass said, you can finish those, you know, do the work you have to before really getting into your ministry. And so the last case was a woman who was a national school teacher. He delivered her baby. And so it was actually the Minister for Education delivering her baby.
And speaking of that first ministry, and again, this is a sort of a theme of his presidency. He felt afterwards that he was slightly hard done by because he did a huge amount of what was regarded as the spade work for introducing free education into Ireland, which, of course, his successor, Don O'Malley,
got
a huge amount of credit for.
He was Minister for Industry and Commerce. They set up a new department, Department of Labour, the first one, and he was the first minister in there. And then the big one, 1969, Minister for Foreign Affairs. Now, not long afterwards, Bloody Sunday erupted.
In 1972.
Yeah.
Derry. Been thrown right in the deep end from the get-go.
And as Minister for Foreign Affairs, actually, he decided that the North, Northern Ireland, the Troubles should have an international attention on it and it should be dealt with at the highest possible levels, including right up to the United Nations. So he went to New York.
And they'd been a bit reluctant to sort of get the UN involved in this up to now. So
government had been dragging its heels on this.
Yeah.
So there he is. He makes an impassioned plea for attention in the United Nations.
Either it's a loosening of totally undisciplined troops or a cold decision taken in London to kill people. Whichever it is, the situation is totally changed. From my government, we find ourselves with a neighbour practising the arts of war on our people. We have to find a solution for it.
The language is very strong, but it didn't really have any effect because, as we know, I mean, the North, there was no interventions and the North just kept escalating and just descending into complete violence.
The UK had a veto, of course, on any of this being adopted formally.
And of course, this is also a time when, now we can't go into the story because it's just so long and so mad and complicated, but the arms crisis, a huge political scandal in 1970, which essentially, look, it was triggered by alleged involvement of a couple of cabinet ministers in a conspiracy to smuggle arms over the border to the IRA to arm them in the face of escalating violence against Catholics and the nationalist community. So that's really, I suppose, it in a kind of a creaky nutshell, let's say. And I'm sure there'll be lots of people going, well, actually, but look, we'll just leave it at that. But of course, the fallout of this probably ended up in one of the most remarkable pieces of footage of Paddy Hillary that sort of flies in the face of
him being quiet and retiring.
And it sort of showed, you know, just what a kind of dedicated Fianna Fáiler he was and how loyal to the then Taoiseach Jack Lynch was, who was under massive pressure. Because obviously, when the arms crisis happened, the two ministers were expelled from cabinet and a third,
resigned.
Kevin Boland resigned.
And Haughey and Blaney were the other
two. Yes, Neil Blaney and Charles Haughey, who will feature in again. They were resigned anyway. It caused a massive split, huge rebellion. Along came the 1971 Ardèche. And this footage is absolutely amazing.
You know, it's like as if Scorsese shot it. There was I was looking back at the archive clips last night, black and white, rooms full of men, of course, suits, the mohair suits, as they were known, and smoke everywhere, Matt. You remember, you know, you've looked at these as well.
Yeah, I don't remember it from the time, Flora. I have seen the images of it subsequently, but it is one of the seminal periods of Irish political life. And it had, of course, the return of Charles Haughey from what seemed like the ignominious end to his career after he defeated the charges at the arms trial. And then it would be very, very important how The relationship between Paddy Hillary as president and Charles Haughey when he became Taoiseach, what transpired over that period.
Yeah. What was the famous line of...
Oh yeah, he was Hillary. Up on the stage hopping mad and he literally just began shouting at the crowd and there literally are scuffles breaking out, right? And you can sort of see the rebels and they're all, there's digging and there's scuffles going on. And
party's in crisis.
Yeah, and he literally just roars red-faced, "Ye can have Boland, but ye can't have Fianna Fáil." Like, it was just, it's the clip is so worth just calling up. And anybody who has the later image of Paddy Hillary as this piano guy in the suit, quietly going about his business in the Irish, or even in later years with the fishing cap, kind of pottering around Spanish Point, like, that just shows a totally different side of him.
So it was Hillary really who led the negotiations for Ireland joining the EEC. We signed in 1973. And Hillary became Ireland's first EEC commissioner. You could say that was possibly a reward for his good work in those ministries.
So he wasn't
ministries.
Just a partisan Fianna Fáiler. He was a bit of a Europhile.
He was, and he spoke several languages. And now he's at the heart of Europe working for Ireland, but very much for his, it was a European brief. Mm. And he wasn't just working for Ireland. But one of the things that was most successful in that career commission was, and this is often forgotten about Hillary, was his championing of women's rights. So equal pay for women, again, that's something the Irish government had been dragging its heels on. Yeah. And equal rights for women, and he led the charge on that.
You're listening to both of you. I'm struck by the fact that we will be talking about Patrick Hillary's 14 years as president, which in many respects became his legacy and not a particularly powerful legacy that, you know, people would have regarded him very much as almost the passive president who didn't do much other than play golf and tour the world on Ireland's behalf. Mm. And from what I'm hearing from the two of you, this was a man with significant political pedigree who had done a lot in his ministries and who also was very important to us joining what was then the European Economic Community when it went from 6 to 9 countries and was more of a trading bloc at that stage rather than the more cohesive and larger European Union that we have. But that this was a man with achievements which have been largely overlooked.
And also I think on that, Matt, you see everywhere from his early days the evidence that he was just going to play it straight. So in Europe, he wasn't going to, you know, look only after Ireland's interests. He was looking after the interests of all member states. In the presidency, he wasn't going to be swayed by politicians. He was very careful to do the right thing.
At this particular juncture, I mean, Ireland was in a shockingly bad state. You know, you had, by the time that he, you know, he was going to be our fourth president in a decade in the 70s, which was extraordinary. And, you know, we will see that, you know, as we kind of talk on, that probably the quietest place and the calmest place in Ireland during the 1980s was Ars an Uachtaráin.
But can I ask there, again, you're the presidential expert, so I have to ask the question of you of this.
What a rare thing. I've been
flattery
really out here now.
Everywhere, hopefully. But did he see it almost as a punishment been required to go to the role of the presidency, which, while though important symbolically and important constitutionally, took him out of the front line of active service, that it stopped him from achieving things and doing things in public life, and that he saw it as something perhaps of a premature retirement?
Oh, he talked of it as a vacuum. I'm going into a vacuum that is going to be hard to explain with his line at the time.
It was very clear that he wasn't going to be returned to Brussels for...
It's very clear
he wasn't to be returned to Europe for a second term.
Yeah, so 1976, and he's unemployed for the first time in 25 years.
So, you know, he's really sort of knocking around and not sure what he was going to do, and himself and Maeve were actually talking about maybe going to Africa and to pursue some kind of medical... research over there, because when he was studying medicine, one of his big things was tuberculosis. That was one of his major areas of research. So even for the second time, it looked like he might, you know, walk away from politics and not, you know, and not actually pursue a political career beyond.
And then, as you say, Matt, he ends up in the Oras. So O'Dolly resigns. There's again turmoil, you know, we're without a president again. And so he was approached. Mm. And a bit like going right back to our first president, Hyde, this was an approach by Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. So there was...
To avoid an election partly as well, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was a consensus that he was a reputable guy who was a hardworking minister and that he would... his experience in Europe, of course, and that he would represent us very well on the international stage too.
But also somebody who was perceived not to rock the boat, who would be effectively an establishment figure and who, at a time when we had what was going on in Northern Ireland, very prominent in everybody's thinking, they wanted, I presume, somebody who could be trusted not to go off the reservation.
Selecting him, the reasoning was we've had three, we can't afford an election, the economy wasn't great. But it did turn out possibly to be prescient because he ended up presiding over like possibly the worst decade in modern Ireland. It was shockingly bad. I mean, if you look what was going on throughout the 80s when he was in the Arras, I mean, you had, you know, massive sectarian violence, which wasn't just contained to the north. We had the assassination of Lord Mountbatten in Sligo.
In 1979.
In 1979. And on actually the same day, the IRA killed 18 British soldiers with two bombs in Warren Point. Then, of course, in the beginning of 81, you had the absolute turbulence of the hunger strikes start, yeah, which ran until October of that year and only ended after 10 hunger strikers had died. I mean, if you look at the early 80s, I mean, we had the country went to the polls three times in 1981 and 1982, one of which, of course, will feature prominently in his time in the office. And, you know, you had a spate of incredibly high profile kidnappings. I mean, you had Ben...
Really dramatic.
Yeah, I mean, you had Ben Dunn in 1981. You had Don Tidy in 1983. Jennifer Guinness. You even had the horse Shergar, the racehorse Shergar in 1983.
Was he ever found?
No, never found. No, he was never found.
Where is he, Matt?
Oh, the hell would I know? I'm no way responsible for it.
You know everything. You must know where Shergar is buried. You must know where the bones of Shergar are. You know, it was also the decade that gave us possibly the most famous acronym ever in Irish politics, which was GUBU.
GUBU.
Which was, of course, Matt, what did GUBU stand for?
Grotesque, unbelievable, bizarre and unprecedented.
That's fair play to you.
Top marks.
Top marks, absolutely. And just for, you know, if people are wondering how we lost the plot, the phrase... which has now passed into common use for every single bun fight that breaks out in Leinster House. It essentially followed an extraordinary story. I mean, it was just extraordinary. The Attorney General of the day, Patrick Connolly, resigned after a wanted double murderer, Malcolm MacArthur, was found staying on his property, which, I mean, at the time, I think GUBU is probably actually a bit of an understatement.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about that, because how he almost derailed the conviction of MacArthur, because Connolly had to be recalled from a holiday in America, and when he came back, there was a press conference, and how he said that the Gardaí had got their man, which was preempting the court case that was to follow. But he also used the phrase grotesque, unbelievable, bizarre, unprecedented. He used those words and described what had happened. And then it was one of his great critics, Conor Cruise O'Brien, a former government minister in the 1970s, who is now a writer. He shortened that into the acronym GUBU. And that has stuck for the last, whatever it is now, 45 years in Irish public life as one of the great phrases that's thrown whenever a scandal happens for bizarre circumstances.
It's handy shorthand, isn't it?
It's
really?
Very nice. Yeah. Overused, a bit like how sticking gate onto everything becomes massively overused.
It's got a bit of a swing to it. It's not just like OMG or one of the really boring ones.
And it's distinctively Irish. It's ours. It's for nobody else to have.
That does not travel, absolutely.
There was a degree of austerity in the 1980s as well.
A large.
There was a lot of it, which, you know, is not known by younger generations and might be forgotten a little bit by those who actually lived through it at the time. And recently, I was doing research on the period for the book I'm just bringing out about the story.
Oh, the plug. Here we go.
Really?
It's called Dynasty, available in all good bookstores on the 16th of October.
Now I know why.
Do tell us about it.
The newspapers at the time in the late 80s were full of the bread wars. I mean, like, basically the price of a loaf of bread was one of the major big political issues at the time. And that's just to give you an indication of, You know, Ireland was still quite a poor country back then.
Yeah.
Infamously, Charlie Hawley went on television and gave an address telling everyone to tighten the belts. And we did.
While he was buying Charvet shirts.
While he was buying Charvet shirts and having his debts written off, and AIB wrote off his debts and becoming Taoiseach of over £1 million. So I think sometimes we forget just how much anger there actually was and dissatisfaction about how we felt that Ireland just was not succeeding as an independent state. And maybe the presidency was something of a lightning rod for that, because of the fact that it was seen there to be almost a redundant position that we couldn't afford.
And as well, by at that time, the Aras, when he went into the Aras, he was constantly commenting about, you know, lack of funding for the Aras as well. So he credits some of the blame for him being seen as a do-nothing, lazy president to the fact that he didn't really have an active staff.
Well, I think he also suffered from the fact that he did not have a good personal relationship with Haughey when Haughey took over. In, there were suggestions, there were rumours back in 1979 that Haughey, before he became Taoiseach, was orchestrating to get rid of Hillary as president so that Jack Lynch could be put in as his replacement to make way then for Haughey to become leader of Fianna Fáil. I don't know if there's any truth to all of that, but I think what is true is that during Hillary's time in office, when Haughey would have been Taoiseach, which would have been a good number of those years, shared obviously with Gareth Fitzgerald, that there would not have been, shall we put it mildly, a close or cordial relationship.
But of course, there was something else that played out behind closed doors.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back after this.
This directly relates to Charlie Haughey and the chaos of the early years, the three elections in 1981, 1982.
And on one occasion, a desperate effort made when Gareth Fitzgerald was looking to dissolve the Dáil to have another election by Charles Haughey to persuade Paddy Hillary to allow the opposition the opportunity to form a government rather than having an election. Of course, Haughey didn't make the intervention personally. Brian Lenehan did, which of course led on to the revelation of Brian Lenehan's famous attempt to influence Paddy Hillary not to dissolve the Dáil, and Hillary issuing the invitation to do that.
Floor was looking at the actual logs.
I found the phone logs.
She found the phone logs.
Did
and
you?
It gives, it gives a real sense of the absolute desperation that was going on. They desperately were trying to not lose power.
So
Brian Lennon was a busy man on the phone that night, wasn't he?
Well,
here
yes.
we go. It lists who phoned Áras Na Uachtaráin and when, and who took the calls. And so it was the president's. So it was secretary to the president who was taking the calls, refusing to pass them on. And there were 8 phone calls altogether. And we know there were 3 phone callers, 3 from Fianna Fáil. We know that one was Haughey and one was definitely Brian Lennon, as listed here. Gareth Fitzgerald has spoken of when he went to Áras Na Uachtaráin to have that conversation with Hillary, asking him to dissolve the Dáil, that it took a lot longer than he expected to be there because Hillary was still apoplectic that he was getting these phone calls to influence him. And that comes straight back to what we were saying about him being a straight up president. Yeah. He wasn't going to be manipulated.
I now have an image of him like the way at the Fianna Fáil Ardéis in 1971, albeit this time probably to a largely empty room, shouting, "You can have Fianna Fáil, but you can't have the presidency or the constitution."
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what shouting went on behind closed doors there, you know. But it was interesting because he was interviewed after his presidency and this came up in the conversation, and he basically said, "Well, look, my job essentially was there to steady the ship of state and not cause controversy." And he felt very strongly that they put him on the spot and by trying to drag him into what was a political controversy. And he, you know, you could actually even see he was still a bit angry about it. But even at that stage, several years past, he still refused to reopen the wound and talk about it. He just said, you know, that what's done is done kind of attitude. But his whole shtick was, "I was there to keep the ship of state and not cause controversy." And that, of course, feeds into the whole perception of his presidency as low-key. But in many ways, it was deliberately low-key. I mean, this was something that he pursued. This is why he ended up being seen as a, you know, somebody who spent most of their time out on the golf course.
Do you know that he had the lowest golf handicap of any head of state in the world?
Was one of Donald Trump's?
Yeah, I was actually
bringing him in. That.
Or Joe Biden's. We haven't got to the sex yet. You promised sex at the outstart.
Gloss over that?
Yeah, well, you've sort of skipped chronologically, I don't know, you're teasing, but you know, I mean, there's only so much teasing you can do.
Over to our sex correspondent.
Nipping off to put the kettle on. We want people to actually like just go, when they're going to get to the sex?
Go for it.
Well, the sex thing happened... or didn't happen.
I think that's a very important distinction legally.
Yes, I know.
Even with dead people,
my survival instinct kicked in just perfectly there, the reflex action. So there he was, pottering around the Irish for about 3 years at this stage.
Yeah, from the 29th of September, wasn't it, to October the 1st, 1979.
Yeah, when the Pope came to town, right? Pope John Paul.
You're not saying Pope and sex in the same sentence, I hope.
I am. I should take a breath there.
Clarify, please.
No, we leave it as it is, to hell. So where I'm going.
You are.
So anyway, along comes John Paul II. And of course, it's a huge deal. Most everybody in the country who was able to walk or was carried was either in the Phoenix Park over 1.5
Galway.
People or Galway or...
Young people of Ireland.
Exactly.
Galway.
Anyway, these mad rumours started to circulate and they were sort of supercharged by the fact that there were, 2,000 foreign media in Ireland covering the visit.
Oh, God. So, and there were several variations on the rumour.
Oh, I mean, the rumours were mad, right?
What was the rumour? Will you tell us what the rumour was?
Jesus, give me a minute, will you? Right. Sorry, I shouldn't be swearing in front of the Pope. Oh, now I'm getting completely confused. Okay, the rumours were that he had a Spanish girlfriend.
A Spanish boyfriend.
He had a sex yacht somewhere around the Isle of Man. Don't ask me what a sex yacht is. I don't know. But I presume it's fairly roomy anyway.
In the Isle of Man, though, as well.
That's so random. Then there was there had been a baby secretly born in Brussels, a baby secretly born in Dublin, that he had a mistress living in the Arras.
Where are you getting all this? I've never heard most of this before.
These were flooding.
They were absolutely circulating wildly. And of course, that himself and Maeve were divorcing. Like when we say rumours were flying around, they were flying around in media circles. So they might.
Okay, this is before we were journalists, though. So I have to make
yes,
this, I mean,
but
like
we kind of know, from and news and editor.
We didn't know, but at the time, no, but it's very.
But you kind of. Yeah, but
we're not aging ourselves this badly.
Yeah. You and I worked together at the Sunday Tribune. How many times did you call me into the office and go, "Wait till I've just heard. Wait till I tell you what I've just heard." Right.
And that's why when Hillary finally made a statement, he felt this has got so out of hand that he needed to go public on it, and he made a statement saying, denying rumours that they were about to get divorced and that he was.
And
going
it was,
to,
sorry, it was like
and that's
Beckett.
The first
so
most people heard of it.
Yeah.
Okay, but you see, this actually it baffles me to a certain extent because my understanding of what happened at the time, which is clearly wrong based on your greater level of expertise and research on this.
Sarcasm.
My understanding was that a lot of the Paul Cars, when they were called up to Ars and Neutron, were baffled that they actually hadn't heard the rumours.
Yeah.
And that they were there going, what is he on about? What's he on? No, they weren't going to look a gift horse in the mouth. They suddenly had a story. And as you've given me, Lise, the Irish Independent from the 4th of October 1979 has a headline, Hillary Scotches the Rumours. Yeah. To which a lot of people have been saying, what rumours?
But even that headline is just extraordinary because, I mean, if that was a headline from today's papers, it would be President denies having a mistress. Like, it's almost sort of giving, the headline is almost like kind of giving him the hook to get himself off. But I think it's because they clearly knew that this was just
bonkers. It's
brilliant because it says President Hillary last night flatly denied reports of difficulties in his marriage that would lead to his resignation from office. He declared, thank God we have a happy family life. I noticed how he got God in very quickly. And in a formal statement, he said, I am not resigning.
Yeah, well, you see, now this leads into the whys and wherefores, of how this rumour kind of circulated.
Yes.
Apparently, it was an excruciating press conference because you can imagine there's the President of Ireland and literally standing there going, look, I have a really happy marriage. And for such a private man, It must have been absolutely such an ordeal for him.
He said afterwards that these rumours were structured. He said time and money had been spent on circulating them. He was asked, did he know who it was?
And ooh, he said, done it.
He did. He wasn't going to reveal the name, but he said, most people know who it is.
Now, Matt, who do you go and speculate?
No, I refuse to engage in idle speculation about a small man living in Kinsealy at the time. But couldn't have been like, you know, I hate to say this, you know, there's a lot of people who believe no smoke without fire.
Oh,
maybe there was something going on somewhere.
Well, the political rumour was certain Fianna Fáil TDs, frontbench, felt that if Hillary resigned, Lynch, the party leader, could then go to the Oris in his place, and that would leave a vacancy at the top of the Fianna Fáil pyramid.
I just found a small thing talking about some of the more madder conspiracy theories about how this got in. According to this piece, some senior politicians blamed MI5 or MI6 in Britain that they planted the story to perfidious Albion because they wanted to embarrass Ireland during the papal visit, and also as revenge for the assassination of Earl Mountbatten, who had, of course, just been killed less than 2 months earlier before the papal visit. The KGB even turned up in one mad rumour as well. Again, they wanted to try and scupper the sort of take the shine off the papal visit.
Russia meddling in international politics?
I mean, God,
well, all because it was the Polish Pope coming to Ireland, perhaps.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking I could believe the MI5, MI6 one. Listen. Then I was thinking, why would I believe KGB? And then think, well, should that Pope?
Oh, I see.
You two have got.
Yeah, I see. Matt is approaching the rabbit hole at great speed now. So that was probably the most dramatic thing that played out in public, we'll say, during his presidency.
It was also a period of enormous political conflict between Charlie Haughey and Gareth Fitzgerald. So you had these two big beasts who were sort of in conflict with each other.
You mean the parties rather than the men, do you?
Well, no, I think, maybe the big two political beasts. But the point still being that people weren't focusing, I suppose, on the presidency when there were these two big competing Taoiseach or leader of the opposition.
Towering over politics.
Yeah.
And they were sucking up all the energy. Yeah, they really were sucking up all the energy. I mean, it was an absolute death match. It was Hunger Games. It was, you know, the men's tennis final in Wimbledon. It was everything. I mean, it really was quite extraordinary. So the attention was all just probably perforce drawn there rather than to this quiet, mild-mannered, sort of almost baldy guy kind of pottering around around Áras an Uachtaráin.
And indeed, and he did very little to sort of change Ireland. You know, the word modernity was coming in.
And he had affected change in his political life.
He had previously, but now he was perhaps remote while things were going on. And the point is that, I suppose, you know, a number of things happened in 1990, the election of Mary Robinson, Ireland getting to the World Cup, which actually makes me wonder, because he still would have been president at the time when Ireland got to the World Cup in 1990. Famously, Charles Haughey went to celebrate with the team. For all the slagging of Charles Haughey for doing that, going to the Champs-Élysées in 1987 to see Stephen Roach win, very good, and going to the World Cup in 1990 as well, and then the welcome for the Irish team back. It's hard to imagine that Michael D. Higgins would have missed the opportunity to have been Ireland's representatives in such events were they to happen now. And yet, Paddy Hillary was almost anonymous.
But I mean, look, he did have some.
But
I mean,
I'm going to stick up for Hillary here because he was kept busy doing presidential things as well. So there were lots of foreign trips, you know, he went and he was the first to really do that. Yeah, we had O'Kelly going to Washington, but Hillary travelled to Australia, to New Zealand. It was a time when Ireland was trying to create trade links with China and Japan. And so he was busy doing a lot of those.
Yes, worthwhile and beneficial, you can certainly argue, but it only increased to an extent the degree of cynicism that he was junketeering, that he was spending money for his own personal enjoyment at the taxpayers' expense when we couldn't afford it.
God, the poor devil, he couldn't catch a break, could he? I swear to God. Well, I mean, did he have anybody interesting call to him then? Us any money?
I mean, there were names like Robert Mugabe, Nelson Mandela, Margaret Thatcher, Ronnie and Nancy Reagan, King Juan Carlos and Queen Sofia of Spain, who he actually brought on a little trip, a private visit to where? Spanish Point, of course. And the correspondence from the time is fascinating as well. It's in his archive in UCD. An extraordinary letter from Muammar Gaddafi of Libya, a two-page rant to poor mild-mannered Hillary, in which he says, "It is you who threatens peace. Peace is in pieces because of you. Hatred is embodied you to the extent that you make the most treacherous means of mass killing to destroy others."
So when was that? And
this was
because
1986, from Gaddafi to Hillary.
Because in what year was the Marita Anne, the famous gun running and various
and
other things? Well, that mightn't have been Libyan related, but there was certainly lots of Libyan guns or Libyan funding.
Landing here, yeah.
That's typical of the sort of Gaddafi hypocrisy, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't think he took the bait. He didn't take the bait, though.
Well, actually, it was accompanied or followed by a brief note from the office of the Taoiseach saying, "We've sent New Year greetings. You can ignore this. You don't need to reply." And that those letters from the departments, from foreign affairs as well, are fascinating because they are usually just a few lines saying, "We're taking care of it."
He declined Queen Elizabeth II's invitation to attend the wedding of Princess Diana to Charles in 1981.
That was quite the snub, wasn't it? When you consider actually that, you know, on the part of the British, you know, Charles was exceptionally close to Mountbatten, who had been murdered in Sligo only less than 2 years earlier. He would have been a very central figure in Charles's wedding if he actually had still been alive. So given that the degree of anger and upset there was in the British royal family about that, to have made that invitation to our president to go was a pretty significant thing. And equally for Charles Haughey to decide, as Taoiseach, to tell the president not to go. Now, I can understand it was also, I don't know the exact timeline, had the hunger strike started at the time when the royal wedding took place.
Yeah, they would have.
So that would have been a degree of sensitivity involved in it as well. But yet, just to show how Ireland was, you know, sort of a divided place at the time, I think the televising of the wedding of Charles and Diana got an enormous amount of coverage here in Ireland. I mean, basically, the shops were empty on the day when people were sat at home having parties. Yeah. So for all to say, "Well, we can't have our president going to that, that'd be terrible."
But turn it on there to tell you we'll all watch it. So he retired aged 67.
Yeah, so still reasonably, he was still reasonably hale, you know, when he left.
Back to Spanish Point. Back to fishing and golf and getting his own life back.
Yeah, but hold on. He'd done plenty of fishing and golf when he was in office as well, hadn't he? It wasn't exactly that he was taking up something he'd been denied during his 14 years in the Oros.
Yeah.
But I'd say he was pretty relieved to leave it at the same time.
He died in Dublin in April 2008 at the age of 84, and he was given a full state funeral.
He sort of has a sort of a strange legacy, though, doesn't he? In that he's almost like, if not quite the forgotten president, but there's almost like he's treated as if he was sort of holding the office until bigger and better presidents came after him.
Yeah, I think he sort of represents the end of a certain type of presidency.
Men.
You know, when, well, men for the start. Well, that's the big point, men. And, you know, I think when the Hillary presidency came to an end, I think Ireland was just ready for something new. And of course, that something very different was just about to blow the doors off the presidency and the cobwebs out the window. Next time, after the election, she sent a big bunch of red roses to Pádraig Flynn, literally saying, you know, "The women of Ireland, thank you." I mean, talk about top trolling.
You've been listening to Think You Know the Presidents, a Today FM production presented by The Last Word. And a big thanks to Matt Cooper for joining us today.
Presented by Lise Hand and Flora McCarthy. Researched by Lise Hand, Flora McCarthy and Siobhan Maguire. Recorded by Thomas Balfe. Sound design by Neil Kavanagh and produced by Siobhan Maguire. Archive clips from British Pathé and President.ie.
Big thanks to the Last Word team and the wider Today FM team.
You can follow us on Go Loud, Apple, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoy what you hear, please like and leave a review.